supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I recently said that lilacs are plants that like acidic soil. I have been challenged by a listener in North Carolina to back that up. So we did some research and we'll tell you what lilacs really like when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's a fascinating phone call show, cats and kittens, at 1-888-346-9499. Charlie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, how you doing today?
I am just ducky, Charles. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you.
And where is Charles well?
It's Forked River, New Jersey.
Forked River, yes. What can we do for Charlie in the Garden State?
Okay, Mike, so this is my third year gardening. I've got a lot of tomato plants in. And one thing I noticed from last year is that a lot of them didn't pollinate because of the heat or whatever. And so this year what I've been doing is stimulating them with an electric toothbrush, and most of the flowers were pollinated. Now, on a lot of them, the tomatoes came out, but some, the yellow part of the flower fell off, but the green part that attaches to the tomato, it's still there with what feels like a BB in there, like it wants to grow. But there's several that haven't really taken off. I was wondering if there's anything, if they're going to come in, or if there's anything I could do to make them produce fruit.
I'm still trying to get this image out of my head. I'm going to take this one to my grave. You know, you can't cross state lines and do stuff like that, you know, attacking your tomato flowers with an electric toothbrush.
Trying to get them shaking around, get the pollen moving around.
Okay, so let's drop back. Have you been growing tomatoes for a lot of years?
3 years now.
3 years. And have you done it well yet?
This year seems to be my most successful. Better each year.
Oh, okay. Are we growing in raised beds or flat earth?
I have containers and flat earth.
Oh, okay. The containers have to be pretty big to get good quality tomatoes.
They are pretty big.
Okay. What are you feeding them?
I use the Espoma organic tomato toner, whatever it is.
Oh, that's good. That's good, because that has a lot of calcium in it, and that'll help protect your tomatoes against blossom end rot, which is a bigger problem in containers than it is in the soil. And they're supported, right? They're in some kind of cages or string? Or
yes, they're all staked. They're in cages.
Okay. Do you mulch the ground at all?
No, I haven't been mulching. I've got some of that black, I guess it's mesh, keeping the weeds down.
Oh, weeds love to grow through that stuff.
I've been through 2 years, haven't had a problem.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, tomatoes, as you note, are not insect-pollinated, although weirdly, in enclosed areas like greenhouses and hydroponic growing situations, they often keep hives of bumblebees inside with the tomatoes because of the vibrations they give off. And that's really how tomatoes pollinate, is a little bit more like corn in that it's just gentle vibrations in the air. Something like an electric toothbrush, quite seriously, might be damaging the flower head, might be damaging the pollen, and just doing too much destruction for the tomato to form adequately after that. As you seem to know, tomatoes aren't going to do anything when we're going through those weeks of 95-degree heat. You know, they just shut down. So you can't expect any flowers that are around then to produce successful tomatoes. And what kind of varieties are you growing?
I've got a Supersonic, Beefmaster, Cherry Tomatoes, and Early Girls.
Oh, okay. So you have a good variety of days to maturity. I'm gonna.
Yeah, that was the plan.
I'm going to suggest you back off on the electricity and give you two choices. What would most duplicate what happens in nature is just to take an oscillating fan, and I don't know how viable this is, and turn it on the plants at a good time, like in the morning as they're starting to dry off, a real good time for pollination, and just hold the fan so that the, you know, the leaves are moving around, and blow the fan a little bit on the flowers. You know, there's camping fans that are battery powered that you could go out there and you could knock a good breeze all up and down your tomato plants. And in the morning, this would also dry them off. I would think doing that a couple days a week would be more effective than what you're doing now, less destructive, certainly, and also a lot less time-consuming than doing the traditional hand pollination with a little paintbrush going from flower to flower.
Okay.
All right?
Yes, sir, and I appreciate you taking my call, Mike. Have a great day.
Oh, my pleasure. I love proposing weird ideas for tomatoes. It just makes my day.
Have a good day, Mike.
All right. Thank you, Charles.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. I love your program.
Well, thank you, Laura. Where are you?
I am in Upperville, Virginia.
All right. What can we do for Laura in Virginia?
I am on a botanical educational center. And we have to have it looking great, but we also want to protect our bees, and we're trying to do things organically, of course. And we have problem with keeping our grass just perfect, as most people do. So I've been reading about corn gluten, and I want to know if you know anything about it, have any experience with it, and what your recommendations are.
Okay, so you work at a botanic garden that has lawn areas, and you want them to be really showy. The most important thing is that the grass can never be cut lower than 3 inches. The real secret to having weed-free turf has nothing to do with chemicals or organics. Most of it is cultural. And the culture begins with making sure the grass is high enough to shade its own soil in the heat. This is especially important with the kind of cool season grasses, fescue and bluegrass, that I presume make up your turf.
That's right.
So if you cut that below 3 inches, the sun is going to bake the soil. It's going to steal the water reserves. There isn't going to be enough of a blade to really capture the solar energy that'll give you strong root growth. And the only result can be weeds because it's going to create bare spots. It's going to create opportunities. Most of the weeds you're probably having trouble with are warm season grasses like crabgrass.
Crabgrass, dandelion, you know, clover, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, good, good, good. Those are all indicators. Crabgrass is indicating too low a cut. Now, yes, corn gluten meal applied at exactly the right time in the spring. So measuring 4 inches below the surface, when that soil temperature begins to approach 55 degrees, that's when you would spread corn gluten meal over your lawn. Now, you're in Virginia, and Virginia and Maryland both have new lawn care laws, so you can't use the kind of heavy dose all at once. You can only spread 9 to 10 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. But you could do that twice in the spring. You could do it once as you were approaching that 55 degrees, and you could do it again like 6 weeks later. That would give the grass a very strong but natural feeding and prevent a lot of dormant weed seeds from germinating. Now, the dandelions are a sign of compacted soil. And I can tell you from my experience at Arlington National Cemetery, nothing helps a lawn that gets a lot of foot traffic more than core aeration, pulling little plugs out of the soil. The time to core aerate a lawn in your part of Virginia would be during the entire month of September. You would rent a big machine or have a service come out, and they would pull little plugs out of the lawn, which is counterintuitive, right? How do you make a lawn look good? By punching holes in it. But you have a lot of visitors. They're always walking on the lawn. You have heavy lawn mowing equipment. All of that compresses the soil, and dandelions are a response to a compacted soil. But if you aerate this fall, you will see a tremendous decrease in dandelions the following year. Mm-hmm. And The clover is a sign, believe it or not, of a hungry lawn. And clover is very attractive to bees.
Right.
Every time you mow the lawn with clover, it gives the lawn a gentle feeding. But clover is generally a sign that a lawn is underfed or it's fed with the wrong things. So corn gluten meal twice in the spring, and then right about when the summer heat breaks and the cooler nights start to roll in more reliably, as you probably know, that's the important time to feed a cool season lawn. Feeding the cool season lawn at that time of year will prevent the germination of cool season weeds, things like chickweed, but it'll also dramatically reduce the amount of clover that pops up naturally.
Well, that sounds great. I think the corn gluten is a good option, and I'm going to give it a try and try to promote it and the aeration and the clippings.
All right. Good luck, Laura.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Delaware Home Show in Newark on Saturday, September 10th, at the Spring City PA Library on Friday evening, September 30th, and at the Fredericksburg, Virginia Home and Garden Show on October 15th and 16th, and at the Huntington Valley Library on Sunday, October 23rd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with wood ash, lilacs, walruses, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. What do lilacs really want? Do they want acidic soil? What do they need to really make them bloom their best? We did some new research, we got some new answers, and maybe we'll even admit a past mistake or two when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Joanne. Where are you?
I have one question, Mike.
Go ahead.
I'm an organic gardener in Oklahoma, and I have peach borers. And I've lost 3 peach trees, 1 apricot, and 1 plum, and I just don't know what to do about it without poisoning my fruit.
Right. Now, when you say peach borers. Are you talking about the oriental fruit moth that lays its egg in the actual fruit, and they tend to go in and, like, destroy the pit, and sometimes the fruit rots out from there? You're talking about the insects that lay their eggs in the bark of the tree.
Exactly.
It's amazing how many of these creatures you can get, because the trees turn into a gummy mess. They look like they've exploded. They look like flies in amber.
Oh, yeah, and there's sappy running out of them. And I've tried to rid them, you know, dig them out, but there were so many that half the bark of the trunk was gone.
Yeah.
I mean, half of the tree was gone. So.
No, peach tree borers are the likeliest cause of the demise of most of my peach trees. I talked to Lee Reich, who's our fruit growing expert, about my peach troubles. And, you know, we just have to start out by acknowledging this is probably the toughest crop, not only for a home gardener to grow, but even for commercial orchards. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, Lee, when I told him about my problems with my 12-year-old trees, he said, well, they're almost done anyway. Most peach trees don't live past 15. So if you want a constant supply of peaches, it's, instead of thinking of it like apple trees, it's more like growing tomatoes. You know, it's almost after a while, they become an annual crop. So if your trees are getting old, don't be afraid to cut them down and plant new ones in slightly different locations.
Well, what happens is they'll grow for about 3 years, and then I'll get a bumper crop, and then they'll die.
Right. Lee called that peach tree early death. He said it's a very common problem, and it's caused by a number of different factors. Now, you said you're in Oklahoma. So I'm presuming your soil is alkaline.
I never had it checked.
You might want to have it checked.
It's very clay.
Because one thing that Lee told me is peach trees prefer an acidic soil, which is something I had not even known or thought of before we had that conversation. So for me in the Northeast, that's not a problem. Our soils tend to be very acidic because of the way the soil was formed and our high levels of rainfall. As you get out to Oklahoma in the West, the soils tend to get much more alkaline, especially in drier climates. So get the pH tested. It turns out that peach trees really benefit from an acidic soil, and that may be something that's way out of whack for your trees. Lee also said that I should have been painting the barks of my peach trees white over the winter to reflect this.
I've been doing that, Mike.
Okay, excellent.
I've been painting them white.
Okay, good, good, good. And then in terms of the borer, there are disruptors, pheromone-disrupting devices that you can buy. These are available commercially. They use them in commercial orchards. And when I saw them years and years ago, they may be different now, but back then they were like giant twist ties that you would put around a couple of branches of the tree, and it would interfere with the moth coming in.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, you might want to consider oil sprays. And have you ever tried the clay spray surround to protect your peaches?
No.
Spraying that on the trunk would also keep them off. But I'm really happy to hear that you're doing the white paint. The most important thing I'm going to suggest is check the soil pH. You may want to use a lot of peat moss or maybe even some sulfur to bring it down. And then learn a little bit more about the life cycle of this borer, the adult, in Oklahoma, and really think about when to protect your trees. But Lee says that it's a combination of stresses. And obviously, Oklahoma is a little warm for peach trees to begin with. So I would also suggest you always make sure you have trees with low chilling requirements that don't need as much of a winter as mine do. And, you know, realize that it probably makes sense for you to put a couple of new trees in the ground every 3 or 4 years.
Well, I've been doing that in Oklahoma because we lose them with the freezes. You know, we get ice storms and stuff like that. So you always have to have extra trees.
Peach tree growing is not for the timid, but the reward when you do it correctly is unlike any other thing in gardening. There's nothing that comes close to biting into a warm peach on a hot summer day.
Oh, you're so right. Well, thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Joanne.
Okay. Ciao.
1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm outside of Greenville, Tennessee, which is in the Tri-Cities area.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. Our friends down in the Abington, Virginia, and...
Johnson City.
Johnson City, right.
I have two, and I don't even know what kind they are, tall, columnar conifers. They don't really have cones, but on each side of my porch. And they've been there for about 6 years, but for the last 2 years, they've been turning brown in places. And I went to Lowe's. They gave me some different kind of fertilizer last year, and nothing has helped. I make sure that they're very well watered. And then I've noticed that my neighbors are having in places on their evergreens spots of the same problem. And this year I haven't done anything to them.
Good, good, good. Yeah. There is a disease called needle cast that shows up and discolors the needles on evergreens and conifers, and a lot of times it can be sometimes just cosmetic, but sometimes it can really hit them hard. Now, you say they've been in place for 6 years. Did you not plant them?
I did plant them, and the new growth at the top looks great.
Huh. So is this just the bottom of the plants?
It's just the bottom of the plant that, yes.
This may be simpler than I originally thought, but I'm going to ask you the basic questions anyway. You already said you didn't feed it again, which is good. Are they mulched?
Yes.
And what are they mulched with?
This year, I've just mulched them with lawn trimmings.
Okay. Now, is your lawn treated?
No.
Okay. I still urge you to leave your clippings on the lawn because those clippings are 10% nitrogen, and they're the perfect food for your lawn.
Right.
So the tops of the trees are getting a lot of sun, and I'm presuming the bottom of the trees are no longer getting a lot of sun. They're being shaded.
But these trees are probably only 18 inches in diameter.
Okay.
So it's all in full sun. It's just, I think that there's no pests that I can see on there. I've examined it closely. I can't see any pests. I can't see any fungus.
Well, no, needle cast, as I recall, because it hit one of my trees once, it just discolors the needle. It makes them look a little rusty. One thing that happens with evergreens, you see these beautiful specimen trees that are out in the middle of lawns, and sometimes it breaks your heart. They're so perfect. Their branches are actually touching the ground. But most trees, as they get older, the sun sticks to the top of the tree, and sometimes even the tree itself will shade the bottom of the tree. And then it's very natural for the lower branches to start to turn brown. And that's when the only way to improve the look of the tree is to remove the browned out branches. Now, if you have branches down low that are no longer producing any color, anything that looks good, you're not doing yourself any ornamental favors by leaving those branches on the tree. I mean, if it is lack of adequate sun at the base of the tree, it could just be a natural browning out that's going to progress. And, you know, the trees tend to look pretty good if you take off the dead and damaged parts. Otherwise, even though you say your lawn isn't treated, and I truly believe you, I don't think the grass clippings are the best mulch here. If you wanted to make a Hail Mary pass, I would sweep away those grass clippings, and then I would either mulch underneath the trees with pine straw or with compost, preferably with compost, because if there is a disease that's progressing between the branches of the tree and the soil, the compost will interrupt the flow of that disease. It'll also provide the trees with a very gentle natural feeding as opposed to a chemical fertilizer.
Okay, well.
All right.
I'll just try to take care of them. Thank you very much.
Good luck, Mayor. 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I am doing just ducky today, Chris. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. I'm very good. Excited to be on the show.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. Where are you, sir?
Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
All right. What can we do for Chris in the Carolinas?
Well, I had gone on the website and read the article on solarizing your soil. And we bought a house back in 2013 that had a hill with that traditional red North Carolina clay that had gotten overgrown. And I've just gotten through enough of my to-dos to now start to try to tackle that. But the question I had was, there's some mature trees on that hill that I don't want to affect by solarizing the soil. And also, I wanted to know if you had any tips for solarizing soil on a hill rather than on a flat piece of earth.
As you read in the article, all of the studies agreed that it's not something you can freehand. The soil has to be perfectly leveled, has to be absolutely saturated with water. The researchers watered their plots for like 24 hours to the point of like insane saturation, and then put clear plastic, 1 or 2 mil thick plastic over top. A lot of people will, quote, try it with black plastic because they're just making it up as they go along, and all they do is waste a season. But with clear plastic stretched tightly over leveled soil that's saturated, it's tremendously effective. It kills the most noxious weeds and their seeds, kills soil-borne diseases better than fumigants, kills underground pests like root knot nematodes further south. First of all, what do you want there? See, that's one of the issues, is it's one thing to try to clear an area, but unless you immediately replant it with something stabilizing, you're just going to cause erosion, and then more weeds are going to move in.
My long-term goal was, it's actually in a very, very good area with good sunlight, and I was going to start towards the front and actually terrace the area so that essentially I would have some places to actually do some gardening. So it wouldn't be a one-stop shop where I would be doing the entire hill at once. So I would build the terrace walls almost into the hill so that I would have, I guess you could say, tiered gardening as you move up the hill. But as I was going to do that, to ensure that I wasn't promoting additional weed issues, my thought was to naturally get rid of all those weeds, was to first solarize the soil before I actually terraced the area.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say this. Terracing is an underutilized art, but it's tremendously effective. It goes back to some of the best ancient origins of agriculture. It's very productive, and it looks great. So I think you have a good plan. I would just want to put you in reverse. Now, you talked about not harming trees, but the areas you're talking about are far enough away from the trees that they get good sun, right?
The weed beds go up to the trees currently, so I'd like to kill those weeds, obviously, but the areas where that I would be terracing would be away from the shade of the tree cover.
Okay. What I'm going to recommend to you is get a weed whacker on steroids, essentially. Instead of just a string trimmer, they make them with metal chains and stuff like that that really tear things apart. So I don't want you to kill all the, quote, weeds at once. They're stabilizing the soil that you're going to need. And again, erosion is a massive problem. But I think it would make sense for you to get a high-powered weed whacker, use it to knock things down, and I presume you want to start building these terraces this fall when the weather is pleasant.
Yes.
What I would do is take my time and make these terraces really sweet, and then as each one is done, solarize that soil beginning the following spring. Have it all ready. You'll have the nice flat surface to work with. You get good 2 mil plastic. With your sunlight down there, you might even be able to reuse that plastic as you work up to different levels. But this way, you won't have a flood that'll come down and destroy all your work. You'll still have a lot of root systems in the ground to utilize the water. And then when you're done, just whack those weeds down in the areas between the trees and your new terraces. And that's a great place for what are called arborist wood chips. You get a big load of wood chips delivered, or, you know, you chip up an old tree or something and lay them real thick on that area between the terracing and your trees. That would be your best bet. And that will also break down into good soil for you to replenish your beds after a couple of years.
Well, perfect. Well, that's great. Well, when it gets all done and I've got it all planted, I'll make sure to send you some pictures.
Oh, please do, because these things are gorgeous when they're finished.
Well, Mike, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate the time.
All right. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and make a plaintive plea. Years ago, I grew a variety of Russian heirloom tomato named Black Krim that produced huge multi-pound fruits that were dusky in color and had a naturally smoky flavor. But all the seed I can find under the Black Krim name today produces small to medium-sized tomatoes. Please contact us if you have a source for the big beefsteak-sized Black Krims. My friends all want them back as well. But don't go send in that Black Krim email to garden@whyy.org just yet, because we'll be right back with better blooms on your lilacs and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will ask the question, do lilacs really require an acidic soil, as I said a couple of weeks ago? And otherwise, what can you do to get more blooms on these fabulous but often reluctant flowers? We'll let you know all the answers after a couple more your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Scott. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, pretty good.
And where is Scott pretty good?
Cape May, New Jersey.
All right. What can we do for Scott, who's still down the shore?
Yeah. I bought an old farmhouse, and in the back of the property there, I have Japanese knotweed, and it's a nightmare.
Is it too late to cancel the sale, Scott?
Yeah, it's definitely too late for the sale. But what it was, there was an old barn, and it fell down, I don't know, 50 years ago. So I ripped that all out of the ground, and it was everywhere, the knotweed. And it's still in the back part. But I planted a lot of grass seed to try to combat it, you know, and I dug out as many of the big rhizomes as I could. But, boy, it just constantly springs back up. Every night I walk out here and I pluck them out of the ground. And I don't really like chemicals. People have said you can take, like, some kind of needle and shoot it into the, you know, the root of the plant and all that. But
I can tell you I've got a folder of emails that people poison their land using herbicides you're supposed to mix up 1 to 50. They poured it on full strength and the knotweed just laughed at it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they say, I guess, it gets all its strength from under the ground.
Exactly right. But it is almost exactly like running bamboo in that the real villain is the underground root system that's very vigorous. You know, this was actually introduced as an ornamental plant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was used as a ground cover in hard-to-plant areas to control erosion.
Wow.
So,
I would have never thought that.
So the big question here is, what do you want from this area? What are you going to grow there in its place?
Just grass. And I'll tell you, the grass is definitely combating it, for sure. It's helping, but it still pops up every single day.
All right, good. When did you plant your grass seed?
The grass seed was planted last fall.
Okay,
and it came up really well, really well.
And you remember what grass seed you bought, right? You can match it. You can buy the same seed again?
I could, yes.
What I'm going to suggest to you is get a big load of compost delivered, or even really good high-quality topsoil, spread it over the area in question, and then sow a fresh run of seed in there. And let that come up. Make sure your lawnmower is always set to cut at least 3 inches, never lower than that. And then just treat the grass normally. See where we are at this time next year. And if you're getting good results, if you're still seeing more grass and less knotweed, I think this is a case for using the plant's own strength against itself. And if you take good care of your grass, I mean, there'll probably always still be some knotweed in there, but perhaps not enough to bother you. One other thing you might want to consider, either this season or next season, is to core aerate the area. I don't know if you did any kind of aeration before you planted the first run of seed.
I didn't.
But pulling little plugs out of the ground would relieve the soil compaction that this weed really likes, and the more open soil is something that the lawn grass prefers. So I think just very gently, over time, keep improving the conditions for grass, and the grass will do its best to hold a balance against this plant. Whatever you do, don't till it up, because that's planting.
I heard that before, too.
Yes, that's like how they plant horseradish. They just leave some in the field and till it, and the next year it's completely covered. But do the things that will enhance the health of your grass. You know, cut it 3 inches, always leave the clippings behind, overseed every late August, early September or so, do a couple of aerations, same time of year, and I bet you will strike a balance or perhaps even be much more pleased than that.
Okay, that's a great idea. Thanks so much.
All right, good luck, Scott.
Thank you very much.
1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for...
I have a tomato problem. For years, I have been raising tomatoes in large pots on two decks that I have, and, you know, with great success. And all of a sudden this year, the tomatoes came out, and they have real dark spots coming out of the stem end, you know, like rotten spots and everything.
Okay, wait a minute. Where are you?
I am in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Okay, right outside of Washington.
Yes.
Okay, so your tomatoes are growing in pots. You've been doing it for years successfully. Mm-hmm. Has the soil ever been changed in the pots?
I do that every year and put work in new calcium and lime and everything. The only thing I did differently this year, which I got some larger tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like I've got monster tomatoes out there with rot all the way through them.
Okay, that's bad. Okay, so you don't have blossom end rot, which you probably
right.
already know, because that affects the bottom part
mm-hmm.
of the plant. There's no sign of disease on the leaves? The leaves are all green?
No, I mean, there's a little bit of drying, I guess, but no, they look pretty happy, and they just get... Like I say, the spots just start to grow larger and darker until they're a big mush.
Hmm. And so the tomato actually rots on the plant, but from the top down, not from the bottom up.
Yes, absolutely. It's from the stem end.
And there's no spots on the... See, if it was spots on the leaves, then it would be one of the tomato blights. Because, you know, a lot of tomato diseases and problems don't really affect the fruits. They make the leaves of the plant look awful.
Right,
and
right.
then the plant becomes unproductive. But when the fruit is affected, then you're into the serious problem. What are you feeding them?
Some of the dirt that I was use is like the pre-packaged Miracle-Gro. Sometimes I make a tea of manure or something like that.
Okay, well, don't do either of those things again.
Okay.
Next season, when you're getting your seed starting mix, your potting soil, try to find clean soil that doesn't have either water-holding crystals or chemical fertilizers.
Okay.
Here's what I'm going to suggest. I know there's some really hip garden centers, independent garden centers in your mm-hmm. area. I would like you to go there. And there are two different kinds of compost that you can get in a bag in your region. One of them you're probably familiar with, Leaf-Gro.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yes, it's the entire state of Maryland collects all their leaves and makes this wonderful leaf mold compost from it. But there's
mm-hmm.
also a product available in your area and in many other areas as well, Coast of Maine Lobster Compost. And this is compost that's made from traditional composting methods, you know, using leaves and dry browns and
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they also use the waste from seafood processing plants.
Mm,
and
okay.
things like lobster shells and crab shells and shrimp shells, they contain a substance called chitin that is just like a super nutrient. So what I'm going to suggest, first, take every bad tomato off of every plant. I know it sounds dramatic, but you still, especially where you live and in your kind of environment, you still have plenty of time to grow some more runs of tomatoes. So I would take off every bad tomato, and I would prune above the tomato. Take off a little bit of the stem as well. And I would put these right into a trash bag, and I would seal it up good, and I would put them out with the trash.
Okay.
And then do you have anything on the surface of the soil in these containers?
No.
Okay. Then I would get one or both of these bagged composts. If you get both, mix them 50-50. Hopefully you have room to put a 2-inch layer on the surface of your potting soil. And mm-hmm. then forget manure tea. Every time you water the plants or they get rain, they will get a drink of compost tea on their roots. So they will absorb the nutrients and the disease-fighting potential from this compost as soon as they begin to get watered. There's also the possibility that there's, you know, some of the disease spores have gotten into your soil, and this will be a physical barrier against them bouncing back up. As we're getting out of this terrible heat that you've been through in your area, maybe that'll relax the plants as well.
So that's it. Okay.
All right, Char?
You've given me hope. I thank you, sir.
All right. Good luck.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, cats and kittens, it's time for the question of the week. The time has come, the walrus said, to speak of many things, of lilacs and ashes and how the blooms to bring. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with the question that goes with that intriguing title.
Okay, you are in rare form already. I'll take that title as a warning. Tom in Greenville, North Carolina writes, I heard you say recently that lilacs require acidic soil, much like azaleas. I was curious about your source of information and data on the subject. A lot of us spend a lot of time, money, and effort trying to get our plants to grow and live long and successful lives. It is important that we receive good and accurate information from those who purport to be experts. We look forward to elaboration on this topic. Oh dear, please tell me you didn't send him a computer virus.
Ah, me? No way. That's kind of more like a bacterial infection. Darn all those antibiotics in our food supply. They're to blame. Anyway, Tom asked a legitimate question. Now, he's referring to a call on a previous show from a guy named Jack up in State College, PA, about using ashes from a wood stove on a lilac. People who burn wood in the winter generate a lot of ash, and they're always hoping they can use it on their garden and landscape.
Despite your almost weekly warnings that just because you have a lot of something doesn't mean it's good for your plants.
Ooh, that can be our next pledge drive mug. That line with a picture of somebody who just tilled a big pile of wood chips into their garden, and one of their tomato plants is next to them with big X's over its eyes.
Tomatoes don't have eyes.
Okay, potatoes then. Got you there, scientist, didn't I? Anyway, like a lot of people, Jack had heard that wood ash was good for lilacs. And what I should have said was the much more temperate, you have to be careful with wood ash. It's really alkaline, and most plants want acidic to neutral soil. But if I only spoke temperately, this show would have closed 14 years ago. So instead, I went out on the very long and spindly, lilacs want acidic soil limb.
Well, do they? We're already a third of the way through this thing and you haven't said anything useful yet.
Ooh, my. Seems Tom in Greenville has an ally now. And that's not true. I already warned people not to till wood chips into their garden and to be careful with wood ashes. We're doing great!
Do you even know?
Yeah, I was wrong. When I got the email, I checked a big article we did on lilacs in Organic Gardening magazine back when I was the editor, and everything was seriously fact-checked. It specifies an ideal pH for lilacs of 7 to 8.
8 is alkaline. So wood ashes are actually good for lilacs?
Yeah, sure, maybe, sometimes, probably. Yeah, if you have acidic soil, a little bit of wood ash would almost certainly be beneficial. But, you know, if your soil is already alkaline, like in Oklahoma, parts of the West Coast, and other areas with lesser amounts of rain, no, you don't want to do that.
Okay, so you were half right.
No, not really. Lilacs generally don't do very well in those warmer climates to begin with, which may be why a guy in the Carolinas is paying really close attention when we mention the topic.
So the assumption is that he is struggling lilacs. What's your advice to him?
Really, it's the same advice for everybody who doesn't think their lilacs are blooming enough. First, be patient. It's normal for lilacs to take 4 or 5 seasons in the ground before they really start to flower well. But that time is a good investment. They're really long-lived plants.
That prefer alkaline soil.
You know, I expected you to enjoy this one way too much. Anyway, yes, if your lilac is well-established and you don't think you're getting enough flowers, you should absolutely test the pH of your soil.
And add some wood ash if it's low.
You're killing me. It's a good thing you're not wearing boots. Okay, yes, wood ash or lime. But you won't get good flowers unless the plant also gets lots of sun. And the sad truth is a lilac in the south is generally never going to bloom as well as the same plant in the north. The more winter freezes the plant endures, the more likely it is to produce copious blooms. And many lilacs just won't make it in warmer zones, period. They get really stressed by southern summers.
Could things like afternoon shade and extra watering help?
maybe to keep the basic plant alive, but lilacs really do need winter cold to bloom well. Now, there are some varieties that are said to have lower chilling requirements and to do better in zone 7 and higher. I'd ask my local extension service for recommendations. And wherever you live, only prune them immediately after the flowers fade in the spring. Lilacs set the following year's buds very early in the season. Now, if mildew is an issue, when you do that pruning, remove entire branches to improve the airflow. Otherwise, just remove as many of the faded flower heads as you can. Deadheading also leads to better blooms the following spring.
As does keeping that soil a little on the alkaline side.
Well, that sure was some kind of mea culpa about lilacs, wood ash, the Carolinas, and walruses, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to level my lilac if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Especially if you're emailing us about seeds for that big old heirloom black crim tomato. Oh, and include your location. Unless you're emailing about the seeds, then you can get away with anything. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and be the 7,000th person to like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar keep wood out of our web. Ashen Al Banks is our editor. Gleeful Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, wants me to admit a mistake every week from now on. Our indomitable intern, Emma Bixler, says she's compiled a list of things that takes us through 2020. I'm checking that list twice, Mike McGrath, and naughty or nice, I'll see you again next week. Ho, ho, ho. It's almost time to plant garlic in the north. But what about in more roasty regions? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to grow your own garlic wherever you live. Plus your fabulous phone calls.